with Scott Allen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in this beautiful world. I am your host, Scott J. Allen, and this is Phronesis, Practical Wisdom for Leaders. Now, I am a professor of management at John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio, USA. In addition, I'm a husband and father of three teens. Now, this is a family endeavor. Will played the intro, Kate voiced the intro, and who knows, you may hear from Emily a little later. I'm also an author, entrepreneur, speaker, and co-founder of the Collegiate Leadership Competition. I love to travel, explore new places with family, and learn from others. Phronesis offers a smart, fast-paced discussion about all things leadership and followership, if we're honest. My guests are scholars and practitioners, and we cover relevant topics and incorporate practical tips designed to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. I am proud to share a few updates. According to Listen Notes, Phronesis is listed as among the top 3% of podcasts in the world because of you. So thank you. In addition, the podcast has two sponsors. First, Phronesis is the official podcast of the International Leadership Association, an association that is near and dear to my heart. ILA brings together leaders and those who teach, study, and develop leadership, advancing leadership knowledge and practice for a better world. Learn more at ila-net.org. My second sponsor is the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. At Bowler, we offer several advanced degrees and MBAs, and I'm confident that there's one that will fit your location, interests, and timeline. In fact, our online MBA is ranked as the number one in Ohio and number nine in the United States. We offer international study tours, a contemporary and forward-looking curriculum, and access to senior leaders and flagship organizations. Learn more at business.jcu.edu. You can find links to both sponsors in the show notes. Now, if you like what we're up to, please hit subscribe so you can stay current as we release new episodes each week. You can also share what we're up to with others, friends, colleagues, leaders, teams, students, and others you think will benefit. And now, today's show. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Phronesis Podcast. Thank you so much for checking in wherever you are in the world. Today, we have a really fun conversation with a new friend. This is Les Sylvan, and Les has just completed his PhD. We were talking about this before we got on. Can we call him doctor yet? We don't know. But you know what? It's done. It's in the books. It's been approved. So I don't know. But congratulations, sir. I am very, 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 very happy for you. So Les has been a police officer in Canada for over 30 years, serving with three different police organizations in a wide variety of roles, from a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer in a rural community to a municipal police chief. During his policing career, he was actively involved in numerous public safety initiatives, for which he was recognized by the Governor General of Canada, receiving the Order of Merit of the Police Forces in 2020. He is a life member of the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police and active member of the International Leadership Association. Les recently completed his PhD in Leadership Studies at the University of Victoria, where he explored how meditation and mindfulness could influence the practice of police leadership and become a catalyst for police reform. When not teaching and coaching police officers about leadership or spending time with his family and friends, he can usually be found on the mats practicing his lifelong sport of judo. Now, in this endeavor to produce this podcast, I've had just a number of conversations with a number of individuals in different nooks and crannies of life. And Les, when we crossed paths, I was so intrigued by your work. And we're going to jump into that. We're going to jump into what you found and maybe explore some of your dissertation a little bit. But what else before we begin should listeners know about you that maybe isn't in your formal bio?
Well, thanks, Scott. You know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is where I'm at right now. And of course, I'm very lucky to be living and working here in what's the traditional territories of the Lekwungen and Wasanich First Nations, who's had historical relationships with this land for millennia. It's in Victoria, as close to the university, on Vancouver Island, of course. And I think that's one thing that I'm feeling very grateful about every day. It's kind of, they call it the Hawaii of Canada out here on the island, because we're pretty lucky. We get the good weather and the palm trees, and which people don't really know. But so that's one thing. I'm out here in Victoria, lucky to be here. And other than that, I think it's just this, you know, having been very lucky to have served as a police officer for, you know, over 30 years. And just like anything else, I think just because of it really lined up with who I am as a person. So it flew by. I can't believe how quick it went by. And I have this real sense that it's time for an evolution in policing. Not necessarily a revolution, but it's time for an evolution. And, you know, there's a whole different group of ways that a person or, you know, a group could go about doing that, or you know, different levels of government. But for me, it's about the individual and how can we support individuals go through the change that they need to do on top of the fact that it's already a pretty darn tricky job to begin with. And there's lots of different challenges just to the work. And now we have this need for reform. So that's what really gets me out of bed in the morning is thinking about how can we support police officers, police leaders, so that they can serve the community in a more fair and just way.
I know that your research really kind of was centered on that question right there. How might meditation and mindfulness practice support police leaders in Canada? Before we jump into that, help listeners understand kind of ground level, what are officers experiencing day to day? What is it that you are seeing them endure as they take on this very, very, like you said, tricky role in the first place?
Yeah. You know, it helps me to sort of organize it into two groups. So there's the operational challenges or stressors. That's kind of what everybody would probably imagine when you think about a police officer out there, you know, on the street, keeping communities safe, doing what they do, and the stress that comes with that. You know, and that's not too much of a challenge. Again, I reflect a little bit on my own experience. I mean, you see things that are very challenging and, you know, your belief system gets tested really early on in that career as a police officer. So that's the operational side. But another way to view it is the organizational stressors.
Okay.
And one of the challenges, probably first and foremost, is as a paramilitary organization or culture profession, the way that power is used inside an organization, where unlike, like, let's say teaching or a university, you know, that a full professor doesn't walk around with stars or stripes on their shoulders so that you know that this person has more power than a, let's say, associate professor. But in policing, rank and power is in your face. And again, that is critically important when dealing with critical incidents where people are at risk and the community is, you know, people get hurt or could be killed. There needs to be that clear line of authority. The challenge is that in policing, that's probably less than 10%, maybe even 5% of an actual day as a police employee is in a crisis, like a hostage taking or like a critical incident. But what seems to happen, the research says, and again, sort of through my experience, is that people get used to using the power of the rank. The outcome of that is the stress around abuse of authority and harassment and sort of these oppressive kind of approaches to leadership that tend to happen. And I know that in Canada here, of course, I speak from that experience, but there's been multiple inquiries and reviews and studies done on, you know, how can we create more positive, psychologically safer police organizations? So kind of, I look at it that way, Scott. I look at it as, you know, there's the operational stress, but most police officers, you know that when you're getting into it, that's, yeah, you know, you're going to see some challenging things, but it's when you come back and you're inside the police station, when you have some stressors that originate inside that can be harder to handle. And that's where we start to get into things like moral injury. But inside a police station, your team, when you're out there, when it's about keeping the community safe or yourself safe, so you go home at the end of the day. But when you come back inside it and, you know, maybe through some perceived poor leadership or supervision, you can experience what they're starting to really talk a lot about, the moral injury that occurs inside.
First time I heard that concept was from an American Army veteran. And as I understood that concept, it was, you know, I might be asked to do things that go against my personal value system that, again, I hold with me. So again, in wartime, you have an individual who's given a task and they implement that task, and we could go, you know, wide variety of what that task could be, sniper to secure this location. But if I might carry some of that with me, if it moves against my personal value system, is that how you're defining it as well?
I am, and I'm adding a little something extra, and not me, but, you know, others that I've been researching this area. And that is also the moral injury when someone inside an organization fails you. So there is that part, which is, you know, out there doing work that's, you know, inherently difficult for you individually and your value system. But then also the other piece is that sold out or someone has not stepped up and done their job to support you.
Okay.
In particular, the leadership or the structure or the system, whatever it is. So it's the outside when you're on the road and it's the inside, you know, that these kind of two stressors that seem to be where a lot of the research is done. And of course, they're not that simple. And you know, if you're run down from going from call to call to call or having to deal with some really challenging situations, you know, you're going to pull that into the police station as well and vice versa. If you're thinking about the poor way that you received some feedback or, you know, didn't have a voice inside the police station about something, you know, can manifest itself in how you're treating the public at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes. Okay. So you're at University of Victoria. You're studying leadership. I have to imagine that was a fascinating experience, given what you've experienced over 30 years. What were some critical insights as you began exploring the literature and opportunities that you see?
Well, what comes up for me when you say that, Scott, is that it was quite a challenging time to be a police officer in a university, you know, in 2020.
Okay.
Well, I started in 2018. But again, you know, it kind of ties into why we need police reform. And I believe the backbone of that is education. But it was, you know, in Canada, we've had for the first time in probably 20 years, a reduction in police positivity, the community, the trust, and also confidence in the police. And so, you know, I would be up there taking some classes as part of the early days and at the same time sort of wandering around sort of defund the police and anti-police protests and whatnot that were going on in the university. So, and everybody knew I was, you know, a police officer. And so that was interesting. And I think that was one thing that comes to mind when you ask that question and trying to, you know, understand. And also, I mean, it's clear what these situations that have happened around the world that were horrible. And yet trying to also say, well, hang on a second. There is right now anywhere a whole group of men and women out there doing amazing things for you. So trying to balance that was kind of one of the things. But what I've heard this said before, and you know, I love your show and I listen to it, but I've heard it said before. Someone said, you know, research is extensively research. And so this was for me that when I came to the idea of what is it that I'm going to put my energy into here. And so it's definitely my own experience. And so I consider myself very lucky. When I was a young police recruit, trying to figure all this career out and sort of getting used to even wearing a uniform and walking around and people looking at you and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I had a few experiences really early in my career that made me think I need to figure out a way to cope with some of these things that I'm experiencing.
Wow.
And, you know, the culture at the time was probably more like you would imagine in the late 80s and not being common that we would debrief a call over a beer or, you know, that was kind of the cornerstone of the culture. But I wandered into a meditation studio. It was Transcendental Meditation Studio in the 80s. And I credit that lucky step into that meditation studio as helping me out the next 30 years of my career and having that ability to a regular daily practice of meditation from frontline operational work to dealing with all the organizational stuff we were just talking about. And so, you know, and I think there's some great mindfulness in the workplace has exploded. You know, like I saw a study that before 2003, there was maybe 8 academic or published studies on mindfulness. And since then, there's close to 2,000 since, you know, that have come out. So it's exploding. And of course, with that, you have all the challenges around like leadership. What's the definition of mindfulness? What's the definition of meditation? You know, but this helped me just as much about, you know, when I finished my shift and I would come home to my family, you know, or I'd be out with my friends, you know, having that ability to put that down, to take that body armor off or whatever you want to call it to process some of the things that I've seen. So, and then when I got into formal leadership positions, same thing, that ability to navigate that organizational stuff that we were talking about, I really credit it with my practice of meditation. And so what I wondered was, is this just me or is this like other people who have had long-term practices? Do they also see the world kind of in similar way or do they attribute their practice to helping them or how does it influence them? Again, trying to be neutral and avoid all the positivity bias that comes from this kind of stuff. So that's what I wanted to find out.
Okay. I love it. So I read a book, this might've been 2 years ago now, but it was a book about TM, Transcendental Meditation by Bob Roth. And I had come across TM because of Ray Dalio. I was reading his book, and he was talking about how it had really just helped him throughout his career. And he attributed a lot of his success to that practice. The book was called Strength and Stillness. For me personally, I went to a course, I understood and learned about the practice, and you know, twice a day, 20 minutes a day. I found that I wasn't committing to twice a day, so then I wasn't doing it at all. But then now, in the last 6 months, I've been able to do 20 minutes a day. And last night, I found myself from 8:30 to 10 p.m. at my son's baseball practice. And it was hilarious, Les, because I was in this huge field house where people are playing soccer, baseball, lacrosse, and I turned off my music, shut everything down, and just closed my eyes, focus on the mantra. I knew I had about 30 minutes left, and I just said, you know what? I want to meditate right now. I just want to kind of clear out for the day. And it was so comforting in a way. There was all these noises going on around me, but I just kind of slowed down and paused. And so talk about your practice over the course of those 30 years. Was it twice a day? Was it once a day? How did it work for you?
You know, even to this day, it's a daily practice, so I'm doing it even today. Again, I find the most benefit I get is from twice a day.
Okay.
20 minutes sitting and you know, again, this particular technique. And there are many, obviously, many
yes.
different.
Yes, yes, yes. We're not promoting TM solely right now.
No, you know, they definitely, you know, I've connected here with the local group and some amazing people, and they're keen on helping first responders. And so they're offering training. But aside, it's kind of like the analogy I think of is it's like physical exercise.
Okay.
Like I'm, you know, a little south of 5'9" and not a very strong basketball player. So that's not for me, you know, but I do have other sports that I do and I practice. So one of the things that people talk about is that something like transcendental meditation or a stillness practice, they just can't imagine sitting there for 20 minutes and their body, you know, will react or they just can't do it. And so I think what's important though is that that's just one type of meditation, as you mentioned, and that there's a whole tree of contemplative practice that we often refer to and use as an example that the roots of this tree, and this was done through the Contemplative Mind Organization, and I can send a link to it for you. But the idea is that the roots of this tree are communion with others, or in some cases, there is a religious aspect, so communion with the divine, but it's also awareness. So any practices that a person does that develops this deeper concentration, this greater awareness, this greater connection with others is valuable and is a community contemplative practice. So for me, I started with transcendental meditation, yes, and I've continued to this day. Almost all religious traditions, spiritual traditions, and this is not about that, but have some form of contemplative exercise. So the Christian centering prayer or this idea, and Buddhism, of course, meditation and mindfulness is thousands of years old, you know, maybe more part of a spiritual tradition or a way of being, you know, than a specific practice. But I have tried just about everything.
Okay.
And what I think is important is for police officers in general and for leaders is sometimes the techniques that you can do that take a minute or 60 seconds, you know, as you're transitioning for policing, we would say, you know, you're running from call to call to call. And I, you know, through the course of a 12-hour shift. And I would say that to some people, boy, you know, if you can meet the 7 o'clock less at the beginning of the shift at night versus I meet you at 4:30 in the morning, I'm not always the same. And because I've been to 15 calls or 20 calls, and, you know, if I had a real horrible one or one that I'm, you know, I'm still thinking about, you know, at 4:30 in the morning, well, I know I'm not going to be as patient and calm, you know. And so for me, that meditation became, what things can I do in the moment? What mindfulness practice can I do in the moment to clear my mind, to shake off that last call and to give that person who I'm seeing the compassion and the presence that they need? For me, the TM or those stillness practices is like your cardio that you go out and you do every day. And it helps you so that when you're out, say you're playing soccer or playing baseball, you've got that foundation.
Yep.
And then the specific skills, although people use apps and things, you just, your breath is with you all the time. So yep. That is something, there's, you know, hundreds of different exercises just focusing on your breath. So, and the other thing is, you know, maybe we, in policing, we have what's called the alert tone. So if there's a very critical incident that happens, you'll be driving around your police car or walking your beat or whatever, and the radio will go off with this really distinctive sound that wants everyone's attention. Something's happening. So focusing on that is that, okay, that sound is an automatic trigger to take 4 deep breaths.
Mm.
And just, you know, just to center yourself and listen to what's being said, because it's usually something very serious that you're about to find yourself in. So kind of the other way is to think about it maybe is, yes, there's that formal practice, but there's also informal practice. And it's kind of like, I keep coming back to these parallels for the body and exercise for the mind. And
sure,
some people say, I don't have a half an hour, 20 minutes twice a day to sit there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's like me, what I would sometimes say, I need an hour to go to the gym. I don't have an hour. I'm not doing it.
Yep.
Know? But just like with exercising the body, you know, we could drop down right now and start doing some push-ups. We don't need to go to the gym. We could do some squats against the wall. We don't need
that. Would be a podcast first.
We could do some planks. We could do some leg lifts, or I don't know. I know we're both a little more been around the sun a few more times, so maybe it wouldn't be very many of them, but we could do a few. But anyway, so it's the same thing. You know, there's moments throughout the day for someone to do it. So that's kind of how it's changed for me. And then I had some roles that were quite high risk in my career. And those each, you know, really, really brought the need for me to be able to control my awareness, my body. So, you know, these were undercover for a number of years. And then also a part of emergency response team, as mentioned, as a sniper on the emergency response. So there's times when it was critical to be able to stay calm. And that is how I, in the moment, those informal mindfulness practices, I credit for helping me be able to do that job okay.
Well, I think that's so beautifully said. I mean, I think sometimes our mind can go to, oh, 20 minutes twice a day. Well, no, there's a sweet, I imagine, whether it's a calm app or whether it's just your breath or triggers that you'd said the alarm goes off, or there's that, okay, 4 deep breaths. So there's these practices that can help the individual in these very high stress moments stay present. And, you know, as you were doing this research, I know you spoke with a number of different individuals. What was the spectrum of their practices that they partook in? And then maybe get into a little bit of what you found.
Right. So sort of true to the literature, like we kind of alluded to earlier on about such an exploding field, and so many different definitions like leadership or love, or, you know, the first thing that I was surprised with was what they thought meditation and mindfulness was. So I was very lucky. I had a large Canadian police organization send out an invite for me saying, hey, do you have a regular practice of meditation or mindfulness? And do you want to talk to Les about it? And so they sent this email out, and I ended up with about a dozen senior police leaders. And again, the focus for me has always been, you know, well, how does this impact police leadership? Again, talking about some of these earlier challenges, but it was a wide variety of practices that they were engaged in, from this formal meditation, like we were just talking about, to, well, yes, I meditate, yes, I garden. And someone else said, well, part of my practice is I walk my dog.
Hmm.
And that tail is like the mantra. And I just watch it go side to side to side. And
wow.
That is part of my practice. So a huge variety of different understandings, and a couple that were trained quite a bit in meditation, who said, you know, meditation isn't just about relaxing your mind. It's about accepting your reality. And there's it's what they call this metacognitive self-regulatory capacity. It's about developing that. So that ability to think about what you're thinking about and being aware, you know, and having these thoughts that are maybe not helpful, or, you know, I'm ruminating. And this is when we start to get into some of their findings around well-being and PTSD and trauma as a tool to prevent that rumination, to think about stuff that happened 20 years ago that we all have them. You know, I'm sure. And in policing, they say that in a career, a police officer will have over 900 critical incidents in a 30-year career. Most people go through 3 or 4 in their life. So having that ability to get out of your time machine is part of what they talk about with PTSD and the ability to work through that. So yes, wide variety of practices. These leaders say it helps them in 3 ways. Helps their job performance, helps their relationships, and helps their well-being. And again, I was surprised that most of these individuals, when I said, so how did you start meditation? Or when did you start meditation? Of the group that I had, most of them said, well, it was when I was seeing my therapist for PTSD therapy or talking to my counselor and they said, I need to engage in this practice. Or I had a physical injury and the doctor said, you need to engage in a mental practice, not just a physical one. So that was a kind of one of the first findings. And it's a very small number of people. So I'm not extrapolating or trying to, generalize, of course. And it was a qualitative study. But what I found interesting was, just like, again, back to the analogy of exercise, you wouldn't start exercising after you've had a heart attack. You want to do that before. And I think it's the same thing as the message from these people and my experience is, instead of just teaching police recruits how to run up and down a hill and lift weights, let's teach them how to meditate in the police academy. Let's get that going earlier on. And then, of course, the other part was they all do a whole bunch of things, just like people do cardio and weight training and strength training. Each one of these people in my study do a breath practice and they'll do, like I was saying, walk the dog or that, so a multitude of exercise or practices. And then when it comes to the relationships, again, what came up with them mostly was this idea of, I have this enhanced presence that I didn't have before. When I'm with somebody, I am with them.
Wow.
And I have had that sense that it's improved greatly since I began my practice and is what they've told me. And then also that ability to manage conflict.
Yeah.
And, interpersonal conflict. And a couple of them said, I was a conflict avoidant, but now I approach it like, okay, I'm curious. What's going on here? And I'm in the moment and I'm not thinking about, the past or the future. They're fully present. And then again, that probably was most important for a lot of them is when they go home.
Yeah.
When they have that ability to, maybe they'll sit for a bit, maybe they'll engage in one of these practices, but they're there for their families or their friends or their, their fur babies or whatever. They have that ability to transition through the third category, which is well-being. It helps them reduce their stress, but also this work-life integration. So you finish your job and can you find a practice so that when you walk through the door, you are all that stuff that you've just been dealing with, this is set aside or is, you'll go back to it later versus carrying it in at home and not being the person you want to be for your family.
Yeah. Well, I imagine, I'm super curious and I have not read the dissertation. I've read the abstract. That's about as far as I got right now.
Yeah. And it was pretty abstract.
It was a beautiful abstract. When you were doing your research in the literature review, have there been studies in other, because when you get into the TM literature, there's all kinds of studies that have been done. But when you get into, because you mentioned that policing is paramilitary, are there studies from the military and other similar organizations that you found intriguing?
Yes, that work has been done. And, it's more often, in my understanding of the literature, around the performance. I think Amishi Jha is one of the authors that, really did a lot of work, especially in particular, I should say, special forces type of military people. And they talk about leadership and extremists, these high reliability organizations that need success. You have to be successful. And policing is the same. You have to be successful. So yes, there is that research. Sort of the gold standard, of course, is mindfulness-based stress reduction. MBSR, and it was Jon Kabat-Zinn who sort of brought this into the health field. And what seems to be happening is trying to move from sort of this medical model of helping people that are stressed or in pain to just how can this help people flourish, sort of this whole positive psychology movement. But yes, so there has been a lot of studies, not a lot. There have been quite a few studies that have gone into how does it help a police officer?
Yeah.
Or a firefighter or public safety personnel. What's very light in the literature is how does it help public safety leaders?
Yes.
And so the thing that I think is interesting is that in my profession of policing, everybody starts on the road. Everybody's going to do 10 years of frontline duties before they start to move into these positions of responsibility. And so everybody's carrying around some form of trauma. And so how can they understand that and come to terms with that and also, support the people that they're responsible for leading in a positive way without relying on their rank and that, sir and ma'am, as they call you, as all this paramilitary stuff. Again, which is important, but what often happens is it seems in police culture, it's like when they're deciding where to put the new water cooler, it's like it's a hostage shaking. It's like, you go there, whereas for people to have voice inside their police agencies, for police employees to feel those psychological safety principles and that they are contributing to their organization, that they can be authentic, they can be themselves, these are all critical topics and that requires good leadership.
Yeah.
And so I think mindful leadership, I think of Janice Martirano, I think I heard her at the ILA speak about mindful leadership and how important it is. So a lot of the principles she talks about, you know, sort of dragging those into the world of policing. But I think anyone listening to this, you know, if any of this resonates for them, there is a high stress and there are all the issues around policing and public safety. But I think, don't we all want to be better, you know, better friends, better,
yes,
you know, better.
That's exactly what drew me to it, was that I knew that I was taking on a lot. I knew that I needed a replenishment technique, similar to how exercise can be a replenishment technique, but a replenishment technique that was not a quick fix or was not something that was actually going to drain me further. You know, mm-hmm. You talked about debriefing over a beer or something like that. That actually, you know, does more damage, increases stress long term. So what opportunities do you see as you look at policing? I mean, what are some things now that you're done with this part of the work? What do you see as your future work? What opportunities do you see?
I believe that there is a lot of opportunity to explore this further. But what comes to my mind is when I started policing in the late 80s, I was part of, you know, a small little police department. It was sort of a small detachment in the RCMP. And a couple of us that just finished depot or the police academy convinced the staff sergeant who ran the office to give us an old file room so we could bring our own homemade weights because we were going to have a gym. We want a gym. And this is in the 80s. Some of the more experienced, older police officers are like, why are you doing that? Like, what a waste of time. Like, and we're like, no.
They were smoking a cigarette and drinking a beer when they said that.
They
yes.
were. It was the late 80s, and, yes. and they were still smoking in the office. And, you know, and there would be people that still, you know, had been policing since the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, that because they were in their 30th year or whatever. So that was kind of like, what a crazy idea. But we did. And so now, fast forward 20, 30 years, you won't find a police station anywhere that doesn't have a great physical gym because they understand. People understand. Like us back then in the 80s, like, oh, no, we really need physical fitness. Part of the job. Well, people are like, well, of course we do. So I feel like we're in the 80s of the mind.
Okay.
Now, okay. You've got people like me and others that are out there, Mindful Badge, you know, Mindful Police. Like there's these organizations, everybody's trying to bring their own homemade weights this time for the mind, you know? So I hope my goal is that in 20 years from now, people are saying, well, of course, why did Silver even study this? We all know that you have to take care of your mind. Like, you know, of course. So that's what I'm hoping happens is that people are starting to bring these things and it won't be questioned. Yeah, we have to take care of our mind. Hmm. The next thing I think, so that's, we got the body kind of figured out. We're starting to figure out the mind. And then the next part for me is the work that needs to be done on the spirit.
Hmm.
So, you know, it doesn't take you very long. I can think it was a few weeks into the job where I was asking myself, what the heck is going on here? How did this happen? You know, how are these people not alive anymore? They should be alive. How are these people, you know, not dead? How am I still alive? Like these existential questions happen very early in a young police officer's career. And I know we don't talk about that. And, you know, this idea of sense making, how do you make sense of the stuff that you see? And I think that's the next opportunity for policing is let's look at the holistic. We've got the body. We've got the mind starting to come together. Let's talk about the spiritual part of the job and not in a religious way, you know, obviously, but unless that's what works for you. But how do you make sense of the crazy stuff you see and you put your boots on the next day and come back to work?
Yeah.
And the same thing for police leaders, you know, and again, the prevalence of suicide in policing, prevalence of substance abuse, you know, there are studies that have been done in Canada that the CIPSR, Canadian Institute of Public Safety Research, and what they found in the study 2018 was nearly half of public safety personnel in Canada who had replied to their survey reported clinically significant symptoms that were consistent with one or more mental health disorders. So nearly half of public safety personnel in this study had clinically significant symptoms.
Wow.
So how do you make sense of that? How does a police officer make sense of what they experience? And I think for me personally is to talk about this research and to get out there. We didn't really touch on, you know, this other idea that's come up about, could you imagine a police organization or a police agency where the officers are more present, they're more response-oriented instead of reactive, they have the ability to be more compassionate, there's talk about how this could be a catalyst for police reform. And some of these things that we talked about earlier on, and this is what came through the research, was these police officers saying, I'm sure this is going to help us with our public safety. This will help us with our public trust and the confidence in policing. If the police officers are able to be more present, to be more compassionate, to be, more kind with the people that are traditionally in Canada, and I know it's the same in the United States, but that have been marginalized or have been underserved by policing and the justice system. So this is another idea that there's a lot of research that needs to be done in this area to, move it beyond just an idea, but there's something there, Scott. There is something there about police reform.
Well, for sure. And how are we ensuring that we're taking care of the people who are taking care of our communities? And how are we helping them to take care of themselves as they take care of the community? Because it's heroic work. And like you said, whether it's the stress out in the field or the stress in the organization, how do we better prepare our leaders to be successful in at least creating what we can control? We can control more of what's happening inside the precinct or inside the station, and better prepare those individuals to be successful when serving in those really challenging roles. And I oftentimes will say that that's kind of my passion, is to better understand this puzzle of how do we better prepare leaders to serve in these really gnarly roles. And again, when it gets into the content of the work that you are doing, that's even adds a whole nother level of complexity to the whole endeavor. And the stress is just, to your point, was it 900 critical incidents that police officers experience?
That's correct. During their career.
Okay. Over a 30-year career, 900.
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot. And I just have great respect for the work that you're doing. Obviously, thank you for your service. As we begin to wind down, and this is a little bit of a gear shift. No problem. What have you been reading or listening to? What have you been streaming? What's caught your attention in recent times? Maybe you no longer have to be reading journal articles or writing a really long paper, but is there something that's caught your attention in recent times that listeners might be interested in?
Well, yes, you're right. It's put the keyboard down these last few weeks, and I haven't really been delving into the literature. But you know what happens is, how often over the last 7 years of this PhD I've been doing, I'm like, I got to read this later. I don't have time to read it now, but I'm going to come back to it. So there's a couple things on my bookshelf that I've sort of pulled forward and to that I promised I would read. So I'm very interested in some research done by Railroads University. They have something called the Cascade Institute that talks about the poly crisis.
Okay.
And complexity science, and just how, there are a variety of interrelated crises that are occurring in society, and particularly around healthcare, education, justice, and of course the big one, the planet, the health of the earth. So there is this Cascade Institute has got a very interesting way of unpacking all of that.
Huh. And poly crisis. Interesting.
Yeah. So basically the idea that we have never been more connected, and that we, at the same time, there is no place to hide
on
the planet anymore. And how can we harness the power of collaboration and knowing that there is no place to hide on the planet anymore, and to give humanity better prospects. So that this idea of the poly crisis and the Cascade Institute has caught my attention. There's also some work done called Beyond Intractability, which explores the hyperpolarization in society. And the extreme, not just in government or politics, but how, we've moved down this path of black and white, and how do we avoid the tyranny of the or, and, find the power in the and, that type of stuff. So that fascinates me. And then last night was one of the first games of the Professional Women's Hockey League.
Okay.
It was broadcast here in Canada. And I am very interested in seeing how that goes, and have signed up for a little subscription to watch more, because it's fantastic hockey in Canada. I'm a little bit excited about hockey.
Kind of, so. You're kind of known for that.
Yes. And based on the last couple Olympics, our women are leading the way.
Yes, they are.
I'm excited about that, this Professional Women's Hockey League.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, sir, thank you so much for being with me today. I really, really appreciate the conversation. I know that listeners will have found this dialogue absolutely fascinating, and I just appreciate your work, and I appreciate your friendship, and Keep it up. I hope to see you in Chicago next November.
I'll be there, Scott.
Okay. See you then. Okay, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I found it just absolutely wonderful. Wonderful on a few different levels. I mean, if you are going to take on a position of leadership, you are adding stress to your plate. And if you are adding stress to your plate, what are you also adding? I almost think of it as armor. What armor are you adding to actually build your ability to navigate stress? They're called proactive strategies. For some, that's diet. For some, that's exercise. For some, that's close relationships or their faith or prayer. And this is one of those that you can try to help build up your resilience to stress, to navigate some of those intense situations that leaders find themselves in. Now, of course, Les is speaking about a job that literally just has baked into it those stressors. And how do we in real time help ourselves navigate those very, very challenging situations? So Les, thank you for your good work. The practical wisdom for me, I just said it. Are you arming yourself so that you can navigate the stressors with a sense of grace? Or at least more gracefully. As always, thank you so much for listening in. If you don't have November 7 through 10, Chicago International Leadership Association annual conference on your radar, please put it on there. And looking forward to that in November. And as always, if you like what we're doing, please share this with others. And subscribe to your podcast platform of choice so that you never miss an episode. Take care, everybody. Be well. Bye-bye. You have just finished another episode of Practical Wisdom for Leaders with Scott Allen. To contact me, visit www.scottjallen.net or send me a note at scott@scottjallen.net. I can also be found on Twitter and LinkedIn, so let's connect. Now, if you have feedback, I'd love to hear it. And as always, thank you so much for listening. One final nod to our sponsors, the International Leadership Association and the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.